Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Last week, we brought you the story of 19-year-old Sage Smith, a transgendered woman who went missing from Charlottesville, Virginia in 2012. On the night of November 20th, Sage was supposed to meet a man she'd been seeing and then go to her family's house for Thanksgiving the next day. But when she never returned to her apartment that night or showed up for the holiday, her family knew something was wrong. Did Sage meet foul play at the hands of Eric McFadden, the man she was supposed to meet? Or did someone else cause her disappearance? 8 years later, those are the questions her family is still trying to answer. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Sage Smith. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us for part two of the Sage Smith story. This is a case that has gotten some publicity, but not nearly the amount that similar cases of white women who went missing in the area received. And we're going to talk a lot about that today because there are glaring differences between both coverage and the police investigation. And these are things that need to be talked about. So to the person who said they were tired of hearing us talk about race.
Should probably turn the podcast off now.
Sorry. Yeah. Not sorry. We've also had some really lovely comments about the way we've been talking about these issues. So if any of you would like to leave us a review to counteract that one, that would be cool. And also say something about Ethan. That's nice because the reviews are like the only thing he reads.
I've been trying not to read the reviews, just in case there's a negative one about me that I can't let go of, like the three that are out there right now.
Oh my God, you've counted them. Babe.
Yeah, I know. There's three out of however many. Like everybody says nice things, but I'm not used to social media.
Yeah, I know.
And I cannot let go of the negative.
I know. Meanwhile, I've been writing online for like 15 years or so, and I had a commenter tell me that they hope I got AIDS because I wrote something unfavorable about David Caruso.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been around the block once or twice.
Well, I have not. I have largely avoided being a presence on social media until recently.
Yeah.
So any of my Twitter followers that are out there, I really don't post anything, so don't expect a whole lot from me, but I'm happy that you follow me.
Yes.
The like five people that aren't my family.
I know. But let's get into part two of Sage's story now. When we left off last week, Charlottesville police had made the baffling decision to publicly announce that Eric McFadden was no longer a person of interest in Sage's disappearance. According to them, this was due to a few factors. The fact that his computer and cell phone usage on the night Sage disappeared was normal. The fact that he not only didn't have a car, but didn't know how to drive, and thus would have had a difficult time disposing of a body. The fact that he stayed in town until Dean posted his number on Facebook. And the fact that a witness saw Sage at Wild Wings Cafe around 7 p.m., which could have given Eric time to meet her and then leave her unharmed.
For me, I mean, I understand that evidence is leading them in that direction, but for them to definitively come out and say, like it wasn't him.
Yeah.
I just have a real hard time with that.
Well, so do I. I mean, the fact that he's never, like, he skipped town and he never came back.
Yes, that's another problem that I have. Like, that's a huge problem. They have never questioned him, mm-hmm. to the best of our knowledge.
No.
For sure. Okay, so for
100%,
sure.
100%. They have never questioned him in person. They had the phone call, which I talked about last week, but that was it.
Like, as an investigator, like, you're missing so many body cues.
Yeah.
Over the phone. You can't do a phone interview and rule somebody out.
Right. And, you know, honestly, from all of my true crime knowledge, it does seem like, and I'm not saying that this is the case here, but in general, it does seem like the easiest way to get away with murder is just to not talk. Because, you know, there are so many cases that I can think of where it's very clear who did it. It's really clear what happened. But the people refuse to, like, come in and say anything. They refuse to meet with police. They refuse to do anything. And so
they
just get to go off and live their life. Christine Kupka comes to mind, for instance, a case that in terms of a case that we covered. Bianca Carrasco comes to mind in terms of a case that we covered.
Right. So for the police to just basically dismiss this guy as a suspect.
Yeah.
And it's not even dismiss him. They're like, they definitively came out and said he was no longer a suspect because his computer and cell phone usage was normal. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Again, these are all things that are leading to him being cleared, but without legitimately questioning him.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but we talked about this the last episode, that eyewitness account around 7:30, like that doesn't
around seven,
yeah. Like that doesn't clear him.
Right. No, it really doesn't. And like I said, I mean, I do think it's entirely possible that she could have met him after seven.
Right.
That she kept him waiting and then he decided to keep her waiting.
Right. And look, I'm not saying it's him because there's also no evidence pointing in that direction either. But what I'm saying is that I have a problem with the police just being like, oh, yeah, that's definitely not him.
No, and I do, too. And because what that evidence did for me, and who's as somebody who doesn't matter and isn't involved in the case at all, I mean, what it does for me is think like, oh, OK, well, maybe it's not as clear cut as it seems, because honestly, like I kind of mentioned in the first episode, I had heard about this case before. I'd heard this on other podcasts or whatever. And to me, it was like, oh, yeah, it was obviously this dude who did it. But, you know, once I was researching it and I did learn about the things that I mentioned, I thought, OK, well, those make you think, like they make you stop and wonder if it is as straightforward as it appears on its face. And especially this week, we're going to talk about other people who could possibly be of interest.
All right. Well, yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. Oh, but before we do, I really want to make it clear, and I think we did, but there are a few sources out there that say that Eric was in police custody and that they let him go after questioning, but that never happened. Police, to this day, 2021, have never personally met with Eric McFadden.
And you're getting that from the police?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, no, the police. The police, like, are admitting that they have never
questioned
Eric in person.
Correct.
Okay.
And as the months turned into years, police still could not find Eric McFadden. The case was allegedly still open, but it kind of only sounds like they did work around either the anniversary or like when the public would make a stink about something. One of these times was in 2015 when police decided to re-canvass Main Street for some reason. And Main Street...
This is 3 years later.
3 years later. And Main Street is where...
Right, where
she was
missing.
Last seen. But like, okay. I mean, I don't know what they were expecting to find there.
Yeah, 3 years later, they're expecting to find some eyewitness that remembers things from 3 years ago that hadn't come forward or hadn't been questioned?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Sounds like a PR move.
Exactly. So between that and telling the world that Eric was no longer a suspect, the family was not happy with the Charlottesville Police Department. As the three-year anniversary of Sage's disappearance was looming, her family increased their public outcry of the way her case had been handled. On November 16th, the family released a statement that read in part, quote, We are appalled that the police department's new findings are largely based on information coming directly from the only person of interest slash suspect ever named in the investigation, as well as lack of any other evidence. We are appalled that the police are only now canvassing West Main for leads 3 years too late. We are appalled that the police are only now offering to increase the reward fund for information on Sage's whereabouts months after the family and community advocates had to force a $10,000 increase by the city. Would that the police department had pursued community support for Sage's search and reward fund as vigorously as our FOIA request revealed that they had for cis white Hannah Graham. Would that the media were moved by Sage's humanity to see hers as a story worth telling on its own merit rather than in relation to the area's missing white women in response to public outcry or not at all. End quote.
I've said this before in particular in the Cindy Song case, it's absolutely imperative during these investigations for you to have the trust of the family, mm-hmm. And I understand that initially there might be suspects within the family, but that's another reason why you need to build that trust. Because if there's suspects within the family, if it is somebody from the family, that if you have their trust, you're going to get information leading in that direction. But even beyond that, you need the trust of the family to continue the investigation. If they're not trusting the investigator, they're not going to be as forthright with information, which we already saw in this case.
Right.
And it was the same with Cindy Song. They just very quickly said, oh, it's a cultural issue.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Immediately.
Right. Like it's super.
And like the cultural issue is they were pissed that the cops weren't doing their job.
Right. Yeah.
I mean. And this one, and I'll get into a little bit more about this, but we did talk last week about how this investigation got off on a bad start with the family because Dean had run-ins with the Charlottesville police and even specific detectives on this case.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many detectives Charlottesville has.
Well, exactly. But, not a ton. So,
but,
it
might have probably been better if they reassigned some of them.
Yeah. I don't know if that was really an option, honestly.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying that you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
With the limited resources you have as a police department. But mm-hmm. I think effort should have gone into building that relationship with Dean.
Right.
Very clearly have a conversation like, hey, look, I know we've had issues in the past or whatever, but that's all squashed. We're talking about your missing daughter now. You know what I mean?
Especially because Dean's issues were drugs. When he went to prison, right. It was for drugs. Who cares?
Yeah.
When it comes to a situation like this, who cares? But, to me, if I were them, I can't imagine a world in which they wouldn't do everything in their power to make Miss Cookie happy. And they did not. And so that's the part that I don't understand. I can understand if you're okay, well, Dean, whatever. But if Miss Cookie's pissed at you, you should look within yourself, I feel like. Because I think the problem lies with you. I do want to take a quick detour, just briefly, because I don't want to do what they accused the media of doing in that statement, which is, talk about Sage's disappearance only in context of these other disappearances. But I do think it's important to talk about them briefly because there are stark differences in how missing people were handled by both the local media and national media, really, and by the Charlottesville police. And I think it is really important to talk about. And I don't think you can tell the story of Sage's disappearance without talking about the disparity. So there are two women, Hannah Graham and Morgan Harrington. Both were white women around the same age as Sage. They both went missing in Charlottesville. Harrington in 2009 and Graham in 2014. So Sage disappeared smack in the middle.
And I've actually heard of Hannah Graham.
I know,
Which is, again, crazy.
Because you don't know anything about anything.
Yes.
But I mean, we're in Virginia and it was such a huge story here.
Right.
Even up in Northern Virginia, we're not in the Charlottesville area.
I mean, yeah, we're not, but there's a lot of UVA grads in this area.
Right. Right, for sure. And so, yeah, that like we definitely knew about that. I mean, I knew about Morgan Harrington too, but, you know. In any case, both of them garnered extensive media coverage and search efforts by both police and community volunteers. Siege's family had already seen the outcry around Morgan's disappearance, so they really noticed the relative silence around Siege's. And then this was compounded in 2014 when Hannah disappeared. That search became the largest in Charlottesville's history, with over 1,000 volunteers mobilizing to find her. And police called it like the most intensive search in Virginia's history, though, you know, I don't really have a way of quantifying that. Chief Timothy Longo was the same chief who handled Sage's case and the same one who wouldn't meet with her family for 9 months. In this case, in Hannah's, he publicly asked for landowners to assist by searching for Hannah on their properties. He never made any such plea on Sage's behalf. Rashad Langston, Sage's younger sister, told RVA magazine this year, quote, "When Hannah Graham, a college student, went missing, thousands of people were out in yellow vests looking for her, even outside of Charlottesville, out in fields looking for her. It was very disheartening to see. They even asked the city council for more money than they did for Sage. They did not do any press for Sage. When Charlottesville Police Chief Longo was asked why he put more effort into Hannah's case, he said she reminded him of his daughter. Which is sad because growing up, I used to hang out with Chief Longo's kids. We would carpool together, so they knew my sibling. They knew Sage. However, they connected more with Hannah Graham, a complete stranger." End quote.
Or the chief was peddling that for his constituents.
I think it's both. I do, because, so, I mean, like, literally, he, I mean, I talk about this a little bit more, like the press conferences he gave. I mean, his whole persona was completely different. And it's just what it always is. It's missing white women that gets the most attention. And that's what you as a police chief have to make sure that all of your ducks are in a row optics wise. And when it's a black transgendered woman, like, nobody cares.
There needs to be a national standardization of methods of investigation for missing persons. And there isn't.
I mean, there's not a national standard of anything for anything.
Well, I agree, but that's not the podcast that we're on right now. I mean, you shouldn't, I understand each case is different, but there needs to be some minimum, at least, where things are checked off and done correctly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like there is across the board.
I mean, I would agree, but I mean, this just broke my heart because I really do feel like a lot of this is who people identify with and, you know, the people in power who are predominantly white, they do see somebody like Hannah Graham and they see their daughter and they see somebody like Sage and they can't identify with her because they don't have anyone in their life.
But who cares? I don't give a shit if you identify with it. You're the fucking chief of police.
Well, of course, like, but I mean, that's...
Your job is to enforce laws, to investigate missing persons, to investigate crimes. Like, it doesn't matter who the victim is. It doesn't matter who anybody is in the case.
Of course not, but you know that's not the world we live in.
Well, it infuriates me.
Of course it does. It's literally the whole point of this podcast. Mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. The bodies of both Hannah and Morgan were eventually found, and they were both victims of the serial killer Jesse Matthew. And it should also be noted that once they identified Matthew as a suspect and learned that he had skipped town, a nationwide manhunt was immediately launched, and they found him within 72 hours camping on a beach in Texas.
Yet Eric McFadden just gets to go about his business.
Yeah.
Without being interviewed in person.
Because, I mean, honestly, and I'm going to talk about him a lot this episode, but like, I can't imagine that he's hiding that deeply. You know what I mean? Like,
well, no, he's given away his location.
Well, I mean,
presumably.
Yeah, not necessarily at all. He said he was in places. That doesn't mean that he was ever actually there.
Sure.
But yeah.
But he was in contact with the police, you know.
Yeah, and his girlfriend for a time. We've spoken on this show before about how race affects police investigations and into the media coverage of missing people. And this is especially true of the LGBTQ community. It's especially difficult for the transgendered population who experience higher rates of violent crime. And Sage's family thinks that her being Black, transgendered, and poor are all huge reasons why her case had gone nowhere for 8 years, despite having this pretty solid person of interest. You know, we've covered a lot of cases where we don't have anything nearly as solid as what we have in this case. But right. We still, you know, even though we cover cases that haven't been solved, I mean, you can tell there are some where like they really do put in all their effort. They do what they can with what they have. But this does not seem to be one of those.
Yeah. And again, we're not saying that Eric McFadden did it.
No.
But there is not enough evidence to exclude him as a suspect.
Yeah, there's not enough to say that he didn't, and that's the thing. And they're just letting it go, you know? I mean, and Sage's family, going back to like who Chief Longo identified with and his different reactions, you know, they watched those press conferences just like everybody else did, especially in Charlottesville. You know, this was wall-to-wall media coverage. They saw him banging on the lectern and wiping away tears as he spoke about Hannah Graham. Sage's father, Dean, said, quote, "I watched the helicopters come right up and over the field behind my house. They didn't do that for my child," end quote. And I can't imagine just the frustration and sadness that you would feel, one, to have the worst thing possible happen to you as a parent, but then to get this extra slap in the face of seeing that the police chief like super really does not care, not or at least not nearly as much as he does about others.
Not enough to take time out of his busy schedule to meet with the parents.
Right. Requests for support from outside agencies didn't come until 11 days after Sage was reported missing. Detective Mooney, who worked on both Sage and Hannah Graham's cases, said that they contacted the Virginia State Police and the U.S. Marshals. The FBI also offered technical assistance to find Eric, but I also read articles that said this wasn't done until 2013. And either way, neither the VSP or the Marshals ever had anyone assigned to this case. So while they may have been contacted, like they never worked this case at all. But it wasn't just a matter of not contacting outside agencies in a timely manner. CPD didn't seem to think it was important to speak to anyone quickly. Ms. Cookie said that even in the first week of the investigation, she had a hard time reaching Detective Mark Brake, who was the lead detective on Sage's case at the time. Aubrey Carson, who was Sage's roommate and the last person to see her before she left to meet Eric, wasn't even contacted by police until nearly a week after Sage's disappearance. They asked her to come down for an interview, which she agreed to, but she was staying 20 minutes outside of Charlottesville at her grandmother's house, and she didn't have a car, so she needed a ride. Police said that they would come and pick her up, but like they just never showed up to get her. The actual interview didn't take place for another few weeks.
Weeks.
Weeks. Sage's other roommate, Shakira, was never interviewed in person by the police. They called her and asked her for a short statement, but that was it. And I mean, granted, she wasn't in town the day Sage went missing, because remember, they had that party the night before, and she and Sage had like a fight, so she left for Thanksgiving early.
Okay, but hello.
They had a fight and Sage is now missing.
Like, yeah. Again, I'm not saying anything about her, but like, what the hell?
Yeah.
that's a lead you follow up on.
Right. Oh, and I should mention, which is really weird, they never did formally like interview her in person. She never went down to the police station, but sometime later, they actually did accidentally interview her in person. So police received a tip that somebody had seen Sage down in Chincoteague, Virginia, but who they had actually seen was Shakira, because that's where she was living at the time. So they found her and they were like, oh, we got this tip about Sage. And it was just her. She's like, oh yeah, no, I was like Sage's roommate. And to be fair, so I watched the Disappeared episode and Shakira's interviewed, and like there is a resemblance there. So.
Okay. So it's not just like racism.
No.
Across the board.
I don't think so. But no, I mean, there is definitely a resemblance. So I can see how that could possibly happen. So police did end up talking to her in person, but like in a weird, random, backwards way, much later. At the beginning of the investigation and for several years after, police used an excuse that we've heard before in cases of missing adults. A missing persons case is not a criminal matter. On November 28th, 2012, Charlottesville PD's public information officer gave a press conference. He said, quote, "It's not a criminal case. We have nothing at this point in time that indicates it being a criminal case, which makes it difficult to get warrants and things of that sort because you have to have a criminal case to go in that direction," end quote. Detective Jim Mooney spoke to Emma Eisenberg for that Splinter article that I referenced a lot in the first episode, and he was also on Disappeared. He took over as lead detective, I believe, in 2015. And like, I'm not sure what to think of this guy, because sometimes he seems like he gets it. And other times, I don't know. For instance, he said that he meant to go interview Shakira, but he was on desk duty for most of 2015 because of a knee injury, so he didn't. But on the other hand, of that quote from their PIO, he was like, wait, what? This is obviously a criminal case.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring up the fact that they actually got warrants to get Eric's cell phone.
And his computer. They seized his computer. Yeah.
So they've already gotten warrants in this case.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was his point. But Lieutenant Roberts, the PIO, who said it wasn't a criminal case, said on December 1st, which is after that warrant was granted, that they didn't suspect foul play. And then he doubled down and said they didn't need outside help because it wasn't necessary. And Mooney also didn't seem to understand that. But at the same time, he was like, he was on team Eric isn't a suspect because he stayed in town for a few days.
Maybe they have something that they're not releasing that is excluding Eric.
I don't know. They don't. Mooney is also one of those detectives that I mentioned who had a prior history with Dean. And what's more, Mooney just generally didn't have a great reputation with the Black community in Charlottesville. According to that same Splinter article, there was a rape investigation that he was a part of in 2003 and 2004. The suspect was Black, so he and other detectives basically harassed like every single Black man that they came across and demanded cheek swabs from them. At the end of this, he forced 190 Black men to submit DNA samples. His methods were so egregious that he was named in a 2004 lawsuit against CPD that specifically accused him of assault and battery. He also told Splinter, quote, "The frustrating part is that instead of helping us find Sage, people want to argue about gender issues and things like that. I don't think it should matter," end quote.
He's right. It shouldn't matter.
Oh, right. Like, okay, dude. Like, yeah, you're correct.
But
I think we're coming from two different places. Yeah,
but you guys aren't doing your job because of gender issues.
Yeah. Detective Stamens was also working on this case, and according to Dean, he actually came over to his house one night and just laid it all out and said, listen, we dropped the ball. We weren't prepared for something like this, and, you know, that was it. But, of course, Stamens denies saying this, saying he would never imply that their officers didn't do the very best and blah, blah, blah. Mooney and Chief Longo, who is no longer chief, by the way, he's like a campus.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know. I'm sure if I dug into like Charlottesville political history, there would be, but you know, I've got a full-time job. I can't get into all that, but he's no longer chief, but he also cited anti-cop rhetoric as a reason that maybe Sage's family didn't get the same treatment as Hannah Graham's family.
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Uh-huh. Apparently, Ms. Cookie's public statements about the job CPD was doing didn't sit well with some people. And there was apparently also a vigil at her house where people started chanting, "Fuck the police." And as we all know, it is actually a law that police don't have to do their job if their feelings are hurt. It's in the Constitution.
Yeah. fuck. I'm never going to advocate people saying or disparaging the police when it's not warranted. However, I have been in uniform and I've had people saying very nasty things to me for many years.
Okay, but then why is that okay? But you get sad about internet comments.
okay. It's like I'm trying to focus this on the case here.
Sorry.
But I don't want to sound like an asshole to my fellow law enforcement, but like grow the fuck up. Like it's not new that people hate cops. It's been since the beginning of existence that people hate cops. One way or the other. You want to know how you beat that as an individual police officer and then eventually it becomes more commonplace?
Become a firefighter?
Be a better cop. Be better at your job.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, people are yelling at me, so I'm not going to pay attention to this crime that's happening.
Right.
Do your fucking job and do it better. Reach out to the family. Be somebody better than what they expect you to be. Don't fall into that same stereotype and that same category because that's just going to continue the cycle. And it infuriates me when I hear law enforcement say, well, they were saying, fuck the police. Everybody says, fuck the police. Everybody does. Who cares? Do your fucking job. I knew you were going to bait me into this eventually.
I'm amazed it took so many episodes, honestly.
I've been trying. I've been really fighting it.
Well, now that I've achieved my goal, this is the end of the podcast.
Okay, well, it might be the end of my career.
It's fine. But I shouldn't just completely give shit to Mooney for not thinking Eric is the guy. Because, again, like you and I have said, like we don't know if he's the guy, right?
Yeah, absolutely, we don't.
And other people in Sage's family don't know if he's the guy. Like her father, Dean, he told Splinter, quote, in my gut, it's the friends, end quote. His suspicions fall on Sage's roommate, Aubrey. After Sage went missing, obviously police were like monitoring all of her accounts, you know, to see if she was using her cards and, you know, phone and stuff like that. Just a few days after she was last seen, they got a hit. Sage's EBT card had been used. So police, you know, pulled the records, went to the store, pulled the surveillance footage, hoping that they were just seeing Sage, you know, hoping that she just took off and whatever. But instead, on the footage, they saw Aubrey. So police asked Aubrey about this, and they just played it off saying that, you know, all of the roommates, like, shared cards and stuff in the apartment. Which, no. I mean, we both lived in college apartments. And taking people's cards is just, like, I don't think that's something that we did.
Nobody had money in college.
Well, yeah, sure. But, I mean, I'm sure we both had roommates that, like, labeled their milk in their fridge, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
For sure.
And even benefit of the doubt, like, yeah, we just shared, like, credit cards and whatnot. Like, after the person goes missing,
you're gonna like pick that card up and be like, oh yeah, no, Sage has some money. She's gone,
right?
It's no big deal. I'll just take some money out of her account.
I mean, it's at best extremely tacky, and at worst, maybe indicative of the fact that they knew Sage wasn't coming back and didn't need it. You know, so either way, it's like it's not a good move. Basically, it's just. How much of a bad move it was that's kind of in question.
Did they get any warrants on any of the roommates' computers, no. cell phones?
No. They didn't even interview them. They certainly didn't get warrants.
Well, the
I mean, they searched the apartment. They did interview Aubrey several weeks later. They never interviewed Shakira formally. They got warrants for Eric's apartment, and that was kind of it. So no warrants on anything. They did end up searching the apartment. And I think they were allowed to do that because, like, they got family permission, basically, sure. because I think the apartment was in Sage's name and not, like, the roommate's name or whatever.
Right, but they didn't get the roommate's computers, no, cell phone records, nothing like that. Anything like mm-mm. that. People that are closest. I mean, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not a detective, so what do I know? But it would make sense to me.
Right.
That's where you go first. The people that are closest.
Yeah. And so Dean, you know, at some point after Sage's disappearance, went to the apartment. You know, I don't know if it was to gather her stuff or just to, like, look around or whatever. But when he went there, he found that all of Sage's wigs were gone. And he suspects Aubrey of taking them, but Aubrey denies it. However, that episode of Disappeared, Shakira does say that Aubrey was definitely seen in one of Sage's wigs. And it was, I don't know, it's kind of weird because, like, Shakira talks in the episode, and it's so hard because, you know, those things are edited and whatever. But, like, Shakira talks about how that made her really suspicious, like the card thing and then the wig thing. And she's like, what is happening? You know, she got really suspicious. But then she said, like, that she confronted Aubrey and then, you know, was satisfied by her explanation and was, you know, fine with it.
But wouldn't tell what the explanation was?
No, she not in the episode, and maybe she did, maybe it got cut. I mean, who knows?
Okay, yeah, that's
you
true.
Know
editing.
Yeah, exactly. But in the episode, no, she just says that she was satisfied with her explanation. But Miss Cookie wasn't satisfied. She told The Hook just a few weeks after Sage's disappearance that she didn't understand why Sage's two closest friends just left town instead of helping with the search or attending the vigils that the family held for her. Another interesting person who Shakira immediately suspected was a man who Sage had previously had a relationship with who had assaulted Sage. She said that as soon as she found out Sage was missing, she immediately thought it was this guy. Like, that was the first thing, you know, like, it has to be him. But out of anyone, he certainly has the best alibi. He was incarcerated at the time of Sage's disappearance.
Well, I mean, that's pretty definitive there.
Yeah, exactly. So he got ruled out rather quickly. Yeah, and, yeah. You know, I don't think anybody can blame the cops for that.
No, definitely not.
So once Shakira found that out, she started thinking that Jamal Smith might have something to do with it. As I mentioned in last week's episode, Jamal Smith was the man who Sage got into a fight with the night before she disappeared at Shakira's birthday party. Jamal was apparently someone who used Twitter daily, and on the day of that party, he tweeted that he had been disrespected. Then he didn't post anything for the next month. But on May 11th, 2013, he posted, quote, "I can't stand a N-word that wants to be a woman. I want a man who's a man, not a man who's a woman," end quote. Mooney said that they considered Smith and that he didn't have an alibi. But when he was asked where Smith was now, he said, quote, "Is it Richmond or is it Florida? I can't remember. One of them's in Florida. But without evidence, we couldn't really investigate," end quote.
What? Okay. Oh, you're killing me with this. What? Like, you can't investigate? You can't call them? You can't interview them? You can interview anybody.
Yeah, and all right, I'm not a detective, but, like,
okay, you can't get warrants on anything. Sure, yeah. There's not enough evidence for that, but you can question them.
Like, how do you get evidence if you don't investigate?
Weird.
How does that happen? So I was, as I'm, like, writing this and researching this, I was getting some real Barry PD vibes. Like, well, if he didn't come to the station and tell us that he murdered her, what else could we possibly do? So the point is, in 2015, Siege's case was nowhere, and investigators just kept on pointing fingers at each other and the public as to why. This continued even when CPD got a new chief, Al Thomas Jr. Initially, a new face seemed like it may lead to progress, but the family started running into the same problems, meaning a complete lack of communication. For instance, they found out that CPD reclassified Sage's case from a missing person to a homicide in late 2016 because they read it online in early 2017. And before I know, I see your face, but the reason, so like when reporters got wind of this being reclassified as a homicide and found out, because reporters found out in 2017, police said it happened in late 2016. So reporters are like, how come you didn't announce this? And they said, oh, out of respect for Sage's family, the same family who found out from reporters in 2017. So they didn't release it out of respect for Sage's family, but also didn't tell Sage's family.
And why did they reclassify it?
So their whole thing for reclassifying, they're like, well, we don't have any new evidence or any real reason for reclassifying it, but like, it's been a long time and she hasn't shown up. And reclassifying it as a homicide makes it a criminal matter so we can get like more warrants and stuff.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
If a person goes missing, especially an adult, yes, I understand there are obstacles to that where it becomes difficult to label certain things as criminal. However, you can investigate things as a police officer, whether they're criminal or not, simply by asking.
Right.
And beyond that, if a person goes missing, who is going to investigate it other than the police?
Well,
there's no like missing person agency that's not law enforcement. That's not a thing.
Well, apparently the public, because like this is, it's the same thing with Ralph G. Marie. Like they're just like, all right, well, somebody needs to come forward and tell us what happened. I don't know.
That's an asinine argument. Like you investigate. You're an investigator. You go around and you talk to people. You don't need warrants to do that. You don't.
Yeah. And there were issues too, where like, so Sage's family and other advocates were like, hey, can we set something up where you can talk to people, but like not do it down on the station? Because there are a lot of people who might have information who are never going to set foot in the Charlottesville police station to tell you about it. So like maybe meet people where they are, you know, and police, like they just didn't do it.
So they were given like names or like, or what?
I don't know if they were given names specifically or if it was just a matter of like in general, the family was like, can we try something else here?
Yeah. I mean, a real easy way to do it would be to reach out to some sort of community center.
Yeah, exactly.
Some advocate within the community and say, hey, can we set something up at a church or a community center or whatever? You do the interview there. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
An interview can happen anywhere.
Right.
You might be missing some recording equipment, but like,
I mean, everyone has a friggin' iPhone, you know?
Yeah, you can still record. You can still, you know, get the information that you need. Or at the very least, initial information that could then lead to possible, criminal involvement or possibly having enough evidence to get a warrant
for
said
something.
Information. That's really weird.
Right. So in 2016, yet another detective was put in charge, Regine Wright. She's at least a Black woman, and while it seems like she maybe has more empathy for the family, like she's in the disappeared episode as well, and there still hasn't been a lot of movement since she took over. But Miss Cookie met with her and demanded answers like, are you going to bring in the FBI? To which she received the reply, sure, if and when they're needed. She also wanted to know, what are you doing to find Eric McFadden? Because, fun fact, this was 2016 and Eric was still missing. And what's more, his family never filed a missing persons report, despite the fact that he had not been seen, allegedly, officially, by anyone in his family or otherwise since 2012. a missing persons report wouldn't actually be filed until 2019. So in 2019, Eric's mother was like, oh snap, my kid's missing. So she filed a missing persons report after detectives, like, I guess, came and talked to her. So I mean, like I said, they were doing things sometimes, somewhere, somehow. So they did talk to Eric McFadden's mom, and she's like, wait, what? Like, he's really never been seen? At a press conference, Detective Regine Wright read a statement from Eric's mom, and it said, quote, I am Eric's mother. I did not know my son was missing until 2014. His father has never called me to tell me what happened and will not return my attempts to contact him. I do not know why. I was under the assumption that his father had filed a missing person report until I met with detectives 2 weeks ago. I will like Eric to know that if he is out there and needs help, he can call his mom. I am so sorry I was not there, but I am here now. Let's bring an end to this so everyone involved can begin to heal. End quote.
Is Eric actually missing?
Officially, yes. I mean, officially, there is an open missing persons investigation for Eric McFadden because whether or not he has been seen since 2012 when he left Charlottesville, nobody is admitting that they have seen him since 2012.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, to me, reading between the lines of that statement, it sounds as though, one, Eric's mom clearly like wasn't in his life for some period of time. But more than that, it sounds like she's saying that Eric's father like knows where he is or could know where he is.
Yeah, well, she said that she was under the impression
that he had filed a missing persons report. But like, she's calling him and saying, hey, wait, what the hell's happening? Where is our son? And he won't tell her and he won't like return her calls.
Mm. Yeah.
And to my knowledge, Eric's father hasn't been brought in for questioning in relation to his son's disappearance or Sage's or any of it.
Or the detectives haven't gone up and interviewed his father.
Yeah.
Once again, you, as a detective or a police officer, you don't actually have to sit at your desk and interview people. You can go out and interview people in the field.
Well, I mean, presumably they interviewed his mother in the field because, you know, she...
Doesn't seem like they interviewed the father.
Yeah, it doesn't. The field. And so I don't know. I mean, I really don't know if they did or not, but they've never said that they did publicly. So to my knowledge, like I said, to my knowledge, they have not. I don't know. Seems like somebody I'd want to talk to, though, especially after that statement.
Mm-hmm.
News reports from 2019 say that Eric McFadden could be anywhere from Rochester, New York City, Atlanta, Columbia, South Carolina, Lake City, South Carolina, Baltimore, or Joppa, Maryland.
Okay, so we've got it narrowed down to the East Coast.
Yeah, the entire East Coast,
the
basically.
Entire East Coast.
Like, not Florida, I think, but otherwise, yes. Now, the Hannah Graham case was different because her body was found. So they 100% knew that this was a homicide.
Sure.
But they tracked down Jesse Matthew in Texas in 72 hours. Sage's case has been classified as a homicide since late 2016, yet Charlottesville police are seemingly just hoping that Eric shows up on their doorstep. The basic timeline of Sage's disappearance is a lackluster investigation in late 2012 and early 2013, then nothing. Then it gets reclassified as a homicide in late 2016, but no one tells anyone, including the family, until 2017. The disappeared episode airs in 2018, which prompts new public clamoring by the police to make it appear as though they're still investigating the case. They went back to Sage's apartment 6 years later.
What are they going to find 6 years later?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, they're not wrong when they say that sometimes blood evidence and DNA can like still be left behind.
Sure. You're going to have a real hard time saying that that was actually Sage unless you have Sage's DNA.
Yeah. I mean, again, they would have familial DNA at the very least. I mean, I don't know. Either way, like, yes, theoretically, it could survive over years and multiple tenants, but, you know, certainly a long shot.
Probably should have been investigated initially.
Yeah. And in this case, it didn't seem to result in anything new. So, like, they did the search in 2018. Nothing really came of it. Shocking. Then, in 2019, Eric McFadden is finally declared missing. And that's it. It is 2021 now, and articles from 2019 are the last things that I found about this case online. Police haven't found Eric, and they're asking for anyone who has seen him or had any personal dealings with him since 2012 to please come forward with any information that they may have, no matter how insignificant.
Because they don't want to do their job?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, they're just hoping somebody else does the thing. They're like, so do you like tell us where this dude is?
And look, obviously, people with information that, you know, the police need public sources.
For sure.
To help with the investigation, but it doesn't seem like they're doing anything other than classifying Eric as missing.
Yeah.
Are they actively looking for him? We don't know.
Yeah.
I don't understand. So now they're just like, well, our prime suspect, who we ruled out a while ago.
Right.
Based on almost nothing.
Exactly. And then I will say, so at some point during all of this, like in 2017, I think when they reclassified it as a homicide, they ruled him back in.
Oh, that's weird. So they ruled him out as a suspect when she was missing, when Sage went missing, because he had ordinary searches on his desktop or whatever, on his computer. But now that it's a homicide, I guess those ordinary searches mean that he's might have been searching for something illicit.
I have no idea. Like,
this is stupid.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but this is stupid. Like, a number one suspect the entire time was Eric. And again, we don't know whether he did it or not. We're not saying that.
No.
But now he's declared missing, and we're still at the same point where doesn't seem like anybody's investigating.
Yeah, that's 2019. And granted, yes, people were busy in 2020. It was a bit of a shit show. But like, for the love of God, I mean, how, and again, going back to what I kind of alluded to at the beginning of the episode, I don't think he's hiding that hard. Like, I don't think he's completely changed his identity. I don't think he's like gone underground. I don't think he's Angelina Jolie in like, you know, some spy movie or whatever. Like, he's probably just chilling somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Who's just not actively going to the Charlottesville police. And
whose whereabouts are probably known to some of his family members.
Yeah.
Not his mom, obviously.
I mean, presumably, but I mean, Christ, who knows? But yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, there are definitely people out there who knows where this dude is, for sure. Like, he probably has a social media account. Like, he's probably on Instagram, just like under a different name.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mentioned that when I went into this, I thought it was a straightforward case. Sage met up with Eric and Eric harmed her. And while I do think that it's still the most plausible answer, it doesn't seem as cut and dry to me. Could the friends have something to do with it? What about Jamal Smith? I honestly don't know. But what I do know is Eric McFadden needs to be found and he needs to be talked to in person. Sage Smith's life is important. We need to talk about her. We need to say her name, and we need to help get her family answers. Sage Smith has been missing from Charlottesville, Virginia since November 20th, 2012. She was wearing a black jacket, dark gray sweatpants, and gray and black rain boots. She was around 5'10 and 130 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was 19 years old when she went missing. She would be 28 today. If you have any information about what happened to Sage Smith, please contact the Charlottesville Police Department at 434-970-3280. Or leave an anonymous tip at Crime Stoppers, 434-977-4000. There's a $20,000 reward in this case. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.